Good morning. This is Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ellie Yu, filling in for Larry Mantle today, who's on vacation this week. Larry will be back in the host chair on Monday. Coming up later this hour, we're going to talk about how some cities like San Francisco are seeing an exodus of workers because of the pandemic and how that's affecting the housing and rental market. But first, how the coronavirus continues to disproportionately affect communities of color, particularly Latino and African American households. As we know, people of color are more likely to be essential workers, live in multi-generational households, or may have limited access to health care. All are factors that have played into why certain communities have been just so much more exposed and susceptible to the virus. On top of that, they're also bearing the economic brunt of the pandemic as well. Recent poll data released by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health reveals new information on just how deep the economic impacts have been. Joining us today is Robert Blendon, Professor Emeritus of Public Health Policy and Political Analysis at Harvard. He led the poll looking into how the coronavirus has impacted households across major cities, including here in Los Angeles. Professor Blendon, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
As I mentioned, the poll looks at the impact the pandemic has across four major cities, Los Angeles, New York, Houston, and Chicago. What did you set out to look for when you were doing this poll, and what sort of struck you in these findings?
Quickly, our group has studied a number of national disasters. And what you find is that everybody has a problem, smoke, the wildfires, but a small number of people have incredible problems and they can't function. The poll tried to really identify people who really were having serious financial problems, serious problems educating their kids, as the place where you could go in and try to help them through this difficult event. So what we found, and people keep saying, well, didn't you expect this? And the reason why the findings are both very dramatic and we didn't exactly expect this, if you've been listening to your national news, that Washington spent $1 trillion to give relief on an emergency basis to families impacted seriously by this outbreak. And minority communities are dying at higher rates than were infected. So we thought the consequences of this on their just day-to-day lives financially would be less than would be if it was just their normal problems economically. And what we found is, just focusing on people who had serious financial problems, 72% of Latino communities said, I have a serious financial problem in my household. And it's 60% for blacks, 53% for Native Americans, and only 36% for whites. And so, since so many of the cases are in minority communities, we thought this federal aid, state aid, charitable groups saying we're helping the people most at risk would not have narrowed the racial gap, but the problems would be reduced. So we found among the minority communities, more than 4 in 10 have run out of their savings.
What does this reveal to you about sort of how effective these programs were? You said you were surprised at the findings, given that there were, you know, the federal relief program as well as state programs and, you know, other charitable programs that were available. What does this reveal to you about just how effective those programs were?
For whatever reason, and many of the people that really need to be interviewed again, we don't know why, with so many life jackets being thrown out there, so many minority families are just in incredible shape. And so this is a surprise finding. It wouldn't be a surprise given the historic discrimination, the issue about how the labor market works, that the minority communities would have much higher problems. But the scale of how large they are in communities with the highest death rates and others, we can't answer why all this aid didn't put essentially a life jacket under you and saying, look, you're going to have financial help to get through this until the rest of your life can be put back together. So we don't have an answer for that. What we do have an answer is that these groups are not only dying, they are financially viable. Their households are just hanging on by fingernails here. And whatever aid we have, which, by the way, the federal aid has stopped, is not adequate in keeping their heads above water through a situation where so many are dying and getting infected. But we don't have the answer. What we do have an answer is how many people are at risk. And it's not just some very general thing. They can't pay their utilities. They can't pay their rent. They're really having a problem with credit cards, mortgages, utilities. I mean, we're talking about people who could lose their house or their apartment for this. And the numbers are staggering, and it's among minority communities who are double at risk. They are at risk for this disease, and they are at risk for their households basically falling apart. We also found that minority communities, essentially more than 4 in 10, were going to educate youngsters at home, but even if they have an internet, the connections aren't working. There's real connectivity problems for parents at home trying to educate their kids in this environment for this. And this means that a next generation could be lost if we can't get that working in their homes.
We'd love to hear from listeners about this topic. We'd love to hear from you. How has your life been affected by the pandemic? Have you had to face any economic or social setbacks? Call us at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also tweet us at AirTalk or write us on the AirTalk Facebook page. Professor Blendon, I wonder if, you know, in your polling, how much of these economic troubles were due to the fact that people have lost their jobs because of the economic fallout from the pandemic, versus, you know, just contracting the virus, you know, themselves. I spoke with one grocery store worker a couple months ago who had been out of work for several months after contracting the virus, which I imagine, you know, has a toll on households trying to pay their bills. Can you talk a little bit about what you found?
So we found with people that had someone in the household, they had a very serious financial problems. But I want to go back to your first point. We found that people who had lost their jobs since the outbreak or their wages were cut back had staggering financial problems, much more than people who did not lose their jobs. Mm. And again, for listeners, while we were taken back, all these programs that you discussed were going to prioritize people who had lost their jobs or their wages were cut back. And much larger numbers, their savings were gone. They couldn't pay their bills. And so, both for people who had someone with COVID in their family, and if you lost your job, there just wasn't a safety net here. These people were really putting about much higher. So if I didn't lose my job and no one in the family had COVID, my financial problems are dramatically lower. And so I can't answer why they didn't help, but supposedly unemployment and this supplemental and that, and the people whose wages were cut back, and this really affects minority communities because they're often in a stage of the labor market where benefits to people, if they have to stay out because they're sick, if they can't work full time, are not available to them. And it just showed up in if you lost your job, how much, after all this help, you are still vulnerable. And if I have someone in the household with COVID, you would think they were getting special aid for the whole family because people have to quarantine. But in fact, they were unbelievably at financial risk.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, you've done other polling about major disasters. I wonder how, you know, this pandemic sort of compares to, you know, disasters that you've polled people about in the past.
Whether it's fires or the big hurricanes, what you have is people with lower incomes are staggeringly more hurt by these things. Their housing isn't the same. But a lot of the federal and state aid puts a life raft under them for a period of time. So they get help with their housing. They get help with food. If they don't have utilities, they have temporary things, generators that are brought in. The emergency aid looks like in some other national disasters to help people more stabilize themselves to get through this disaster. And what we are taken back is just so many people. The country as a whole is 46% with serious financial problems. But in the minority communities, the numbers are just huge. And for people who lost their jobs, we just took for granted there would be emergency aid. and you would be covered through some period having lost your job. And we did not find the aid. It's a little bit like those who remember the big hurricanes where you watch the briefing about FEMA trucks coming to help you, and people are standing on their roofs. There's something going wrong where we have not had enough aid, and it doesn't put a life jacket among people who are so vulnerable.
Interesting. I want to go to the phone lines now. We have Michelle calling from Westwood. Michelle, thanks for calling Air Talk.
Yes, I wanted to put into place that the money, I am African American, and the money that the government or EDD has helped in a great way, but it just wasn't enough. My household is feeling it because even though that the money did come in, you're trying to balance, okay, do you put it to the back rent? Do you put it to your utilities? Do you put it to food? Where do you go? And then when it runs out, then what?
Right.
We're feeling it. We are definitely feeling it on greater proportion. So then when they stop the extra $600 and everything, so we're back to square one. So you're making a great decision whether you keep a roof over your head or do you keep food in your stomach.
How are you making ends meet now?
I'm making ends meet now by making masks. I'm going out trying to do things that I can bring extra money in and different things. It's working, but is it enough? Do I have gas in my car? Do I have, those basic means to just survive day to day?
Michelle, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts here on Air Talk. Professor Blendon, I know you collected the poll results from July through the beginning of August when that, you know, extra $600 in unemployment was still happening. I wonder what you would find if you conducted the poll now since the program has expired.
So we are incredibly worried. This isn't some aggregate issue. This is households that may not be able to put together all the pieces just like we heard. I am really worried about the financial viability of millions of households, including people who are in areas with high incidence of this disease. So I'm absolutely worried. If we had these findings when the payments were being made, these are really serious times without support. And I'm also worried about the ability to educate children at home in households which are so financially strained. The future generation requires, if we can't put them in a classroom, that we have working at home education and the parents are not so anxious that they can work with them. We are, unless we can get some help here to people who are at high risk, we are going to watch households really fall apart or be in terrible difficulty. Is just a terrible worry for those of us in this survey.
I also want to bring in Professor Manuel Pastor. He's a professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity at USC and director of the USC Equity Research Institute. He's also a member of Governor Newsom's Task Force on Business and Jobs Recovery. Glad to have you, Professor.
Good to be with you.
Professor Pastor, are any of these stories or poll findings surprising to you? Households, particularly Latino or Black, holes struggling financially?
Well, not really. If you look at who was concentrated in hospitality, restaurants, all the kinds of industries that shut down, over-concentration of both Black and Latino workers. At the same time, you've actually also had Black, Latino, and Pacific Islander workers over-indexed in what are called essential high-risk occupations, jobs where people have continued to go to work, agriculture, meat packing, logistics, grocery store clerks, healthcare, and are at high risk of the disease. And so you wound up with communities of color basically getting the worst of both worlds, being more susceptible to the disease at work and actually also more likely to have found themselves unemployed as a result of the economy shutting down. And therefore, it's no surprise that now in the state of California, 61% of the cases are occurring in Latino communities.
What have we learned from these past few months or maybe 6 months now about understanding what these communities might need and how they might be supported?
Well, I think really what's gone on is that COVID is the disease that reveals our illness of precarious employment, of a racial wealth gap so that people didn't have a cushion to fall back on the lack of legal status, which meant that many immigrants were actually locked out of federal aid, of the unemployment insurance, and even of the pandemic unemployment assistance, $600 a week, that kept some folks alive, the lack of access to health care. And so really what we found out is the fragility of our society pre-pandemic and the racial divides and racial injustices upon which this disease took place. We, as you might know, finished a report reporting on all these kinds of issues for Los Angeles County. And the title of the report was No Going Back, because initially when we started to do the report, we were talking about a roadmap to recovery. But we realized that we did not want to recover in the sense of going back to a world that didn't work for so many, that instead we needed to reimagine and redesign to deal with these underlying vulnerabilities that have led to the patterns revealed in these surveys.
Not going back to the before times, the systemic inequities that existed before then. We're talking with Professor Manuel Pastor, a sociology professor at USC. We also had Robert Blendon join us. He's executive director of the Harvard Opinion Research Program, talking about a poll showing how the pandemic is affecting communities of color financially. We're going to continue this conversation looking at how COVID continues to disproportionately affect certain communities in terms of cases and mortality rates. We'll be right back after this break. Thanks for listening to Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Ellie Yu, filling in for Larry Mantle. Coming up in the next segment, we'll be looking at the exodus of some folks leaving California as the pandemic has allowed many people to work from home. We'd love to hear from you, and if you've left the state or if you're even thinking about it and if you plan to do so long term, you can call us at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-KPCC, or you can comment on our website at kpcc.org. But first, we continue our conversation about the impact of COVID-19 on communities of color here in Los Angeles. Before the break, we were talking about a new poll revealed how many households are struggling financially, particularly Black and Latino residents. I want to give my thanks again to Robert Blendon of Harvard University and co-director of that poll. I want to turn now to the infection and mortality rates we're seeing here in California and in LA County. As in other parts of the country, we've seen higher infection and death rates from the virus among Black and Latino residents. Joining us now to talk about this is Dr. Paul Simon, Chief Science Officer at the LA County Public Health Department. Hi, Dr. Simon.
Good morning.
Dr. Simon, can you just sort of lay out the landscape of what we're seeing right now in the county, you know, 6-7 months into this pandemic, and how the virus is affecting different communities? I've heard you once described it as this is not just one epidemic happening at once. It's multiple epidemics happening at the same time.
That's right. I think it's really quite striking, though, to note just in the space of 7 months, we've now had over 250,000 reported cases of COVID, over 6,000 deaths. We're on pace for COVID to be the leading cause of death in LA County this year. But certainly, there's been disproportionate impacts across the county, very different sort of epidemic dynamics. Early on, for example, we saw the by far largest impacts among seniors and particularly those living in skilled nursing facilities. We've managed to reduce rates of transmission and mortality in that population, but we've seen very rapid spread of the virus into low-income populations, particularly in Latino and African-American populations, also the Pacific Islander population, the American Indian population also disproportionately impacted. We see that these disparities were at their most severe midsummer. Saw an overall great increase in cases and in deaths, also hospitalizations. fortunately, over the last 8 weeks, we've seen a significant decline in cases and deaths and hospitalizations, and we have seen actually a diminishing of the disparities. They haven't gone away, but we have seen a diminishing, and it's not clear exactly why. We've seen that positive trend, but certainly it's promising. But we have a long, long way to go.
Mm-hmm. All right. In July, Latinos were getting the coronavirus at four times the rate than of white and Asian residents in the county. Today, it's about two times that rate. So I understand that gap is closing a little bit. But in terms of places where comparing, you know, wealthy areas versus areas where there's a high rate of poverty, it doesn't seem like the gaps are quite closing there. Can you unpack what might be going on?
Yeah. So, again, if you look at neighborhoods with the highest poverty rates, what you see is mortality about four times higher than in neighborhoods with the lowest poverty rates. And that's a very stubborn disparity. We see it for lots of different conditions, but COVID has certainly magnified it. And with COVID, I think it reflects some of the factors that the earlier speakers mentioned, the fact that there's more crowded housing in lower income communities and more crowded neighborhoods with just more physical interaction. In addition, what we've seen is that many of the low-wage workers continuing to have to work, and in many times in settings that are not very safe. We've seen over 1,000 outbreaks of COVID within the county over the last 6-7 months, and many of them, again, concentrated in manufacturing. Meatpacking, I think, was mentioned. But again, where there are large concentrations of workers with little space, not great ventilation in indoor settings. So it's a very significant issue.
I want to bring back Professor Manuel Pastor, professor of sociology at USC. One thing that struck me about the data in the state is that it's not just older Latinos, but it's working-age Latinos who are dying at a disproportionate rate. State data shows that when you look at deaths of people between the ages of 35 and 49, 76% of those deaths are of people who are Latino, while they only make up 41% of that age group in the entire state. Professor Pastor, I mean, what do you think is accounting for that? Is it higher exposure or access to health care?
It's exactly the factors that the good doctor was referring to. First, over-concentration in jobs that people continue to need to show up for and where there's a lot of proximity to other folks. Second, the Latino population is the most overcrowded in terms of housing. And so if one person gets it, then it will wind up spreading through a family. A third, and I think really important factor, has to do with the lack of documentation status for many immigrant Latinos. Indeed, in Los Angeles County, 18% of the county overall population is either undocumented themselves or living with an undocumented family member. That is important for two reasons. One, because of the lack of assistance, it compels people to find whatever work they might find, even if it's risky. And second, despite the very good efforts of the public health department, there is a reasonable distrust of authorities, particularly in an age in which ICE has been let loose at times in the community. So that trust building, going through community health clinics, really taking a community health approach, is incredibly important in the outreach to this community, and I'm sure that the good doctor would agree.
We also know that Black mortality rates are disproportionately higher. In July, we saw that Black residents in L.A. County were dying at more than three times the rate than of white residents. I want to bring into the conversation Dr. Deborah Prothero-Stith, Dean and Professor of Medicine for the College of Medicine at Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science, a private historically Black graduate school in Los Angeles. Dr. Prothero-Stith, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
I understand that the Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science was founded to help address inequities in healthcare. I mean, what factors have played into why communities of color have been just so greatly impacted by this virus?
I think a lot of the factors have really been discussed and highlighted. The university sits on the Watts-Compton border here in South Los Angeles, serving both a Black and Brown community. And the initial response that we gave was to open a testing site. And in that site tested 74,000 people offering both walk-up and drive-through. And those factors, the overrepresentation of the Latino population among those testing positives, and the mortality rates, we were beginning to see early on in this pandemic. And you know, there's an old saying in the Black community, which is that when America gets a cold, the Black community gets pneumonia. And I think, as you know, our Black and Brown residents of the South Los Angeles community can tell you, that's the experience with COVID-19. And you've got the overrepresentation among those in poverty, and you've got the overrepresentation among those with underlying diseases like diabetes and other chronic diseases. So this is just the double, triple whammy, I guess you could say. And it's exposing America's very, very soft underbelly when it comes to healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, racism before the pandemic, of course, is a public health issue. You know, Black patients being treated differently. I mean, some interesting data from the state. Black residents are disproportionately represented in deaths here in California, but not necessarily in cases, according to recent data. I wonder what that reveals and what's happening when it comes to treatment or other factors when it comes to contracting the virus.
I think one of the ways that many early on in the Black and Brown community contracted the virus was through employment. And I think we are perhaps seeing that the members of the Black community have higher unemployment rates. In some ways, the numbers were lower when it came to actual positive rates in testing among the Black community and much, much higher among the Brown communities here. And it's hard to explain all of that, but as we look at those in the service industry who were really exposed early on, I think we have an explanation for why many of the Latino people were exposed to the virus.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder beyond the virus itself, you know, there are people have comorbidities like diabetes and obesity. I wonder how much of these health issues that were present before the pandemic is being affected now that people might be putting off health care even more, not going to the doctor because of concerns about the virus. I wonder if you can talk about sort of the long-term effects a pandemic is having for people's health beyond the coronavirus itself.
Well, I think there are some negatives, and then hopefully on the long term, we will learn a lot more and pay much more attention to issues of hygiene and infectious diseases as a society. But certainly on the negative side, you have people really unwilling and afraid to go for basic primary care. We're looking at clinic volumes maybe recovering a little bit now, but certainly with a big dip in the number of people who were coming in for routine primary care. I also think that we are in this situation where trust, especially of government health care at the federal level, is impacting people from the standpoint of their willingness to participate in, say, clinical trials or look at a vaccine for COVID. I think one of the biggest issues that healthcare will have to overcome is this issue of the erosion of trust and the erosion of some of our government agencies like CDC as a gold standard for some of the health problems we face as a country.
Interesting. Professor Manuel Pastor, I know you've convened with civic leaders and sort of reimagining what's needed to kind of move forward. You mentioned an initiative called No Going Back. Can you talk about sort of what kind of recommendations might help just close these gaps that we're seeing?
Yes, let me make a comment too about what the conversation that just happened.
Mm-hmm.
That one thing that's really critical to realize is that the plaque mortality rate, if you start to say that it has to do with these pre-existing conditions of obesity and diabetes and hypertension, those are diseases of structural racism.
Mm-hmm.
Those result from people living in places where there aren't parks to play,
mm-hmm.
where there are food deserts, and where the stress of being black in America contributes to hypertension. So one of the really key things that we lift up in our report, our first principle, is the need to combat anti-black racism in all its forms. You know, we've been through the COVID crisis, we're living through it, but we're also in a moment of sort of reckoning with racism in the country as a result of the murder of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and so many others. So we think it's really important to lift up and talk about the racial equity dimensions. It's obviously really important to create an economy that lifts up those at the bottom. It's very important to create a kind of form of California citizenship so that even those who do not have legal status have full access to the kind of health care, social wage, et cetera. And it's incredibly important to rethink our health system, and in particular, our mental health. Because one of the things that I think is not fully discussed here is the trauma of what it means to be living through this period.
Mm.
The trauma of what it means when your community is so over represented in who is dying, who is at risk, who is getting sick. What it means when you've got children who come home and are expected to do remote learning, but where their rate of being disconnected from digital access for black and Latino kids is three times the rate it is for white kids. And so there's a whole period of lost learning that's going on that we need to address as well. So we need to think about dealing with anti-black racism, lifting up the bottom of the economy, ensuring that everybody has access to what they need, and dealing with the mental traumas that have resulted from this period, and dealing with the learning loss.
That's Manuel Pastor, professor of sociology at USC. I want to thank all of my guests for joining us today, Harvard's Robert Blendon, Dr. Paul Simon at LA County Public Health, and Dr. Deborah Prothero-Stith at Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science. Coming up, we'll be looking at the exodus caused by the pandemic in some cities like San Francisco. We'd love to hear from you. Have you considered leaving the state, or have you done so already? Has a pandemic changed your long-term plans? You can call us at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-KPCC, or you can comment on our website at kpcc.org. We'll be right back after this short break.